Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 158. The Father Guido Sarducci School of Geopolitics. I say a resource, you say divide and rule. We say holistic. First off, apologies to Father Guido Sarducci. I did not get his permission to make it a joke. But seriously, this is a serious book. Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam by Mark Curtis. Mark Curtis is an author, journalist, and consultant. His previous books include the best-selling Web of Deceit, Britain's Real Role in the World, and Unpeople, Britain's Secret Human Rights Abuses. He was formerly a research fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, director of the World Development Movement, and head of policy at ActionAid and Christian Aid. You can look up more about him at markcurtis.info and curtisresearch.org. Esteemed journalist and author and filmmaker John Pilger, I heard him mention this book, and it's very significant because of its connection to all that is going on, various things in the Middle East and Syria and elsewhere in today's world. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Starting off this new year, talking about a publication by Serpent's Tail by Mark Curtis, Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam. Only 50 pages or so into it, but I got excited to share because it's just so pertinent and to what's going on today in the world, and because it gives a kind of great blueprint for understanding the shenanigans and the bullshit that goes on with geopolitics, showing how certain things are really policy. And by the way, it's winter time. The heat might come on, might make some noise in the background. So I'll read the back. First, when I reading this book, it's I like to sum things up as much as possible. I think of the Saturday Night Live character Father Guido Sarducci and his 5-minute university, which was just hilarious and truthful sketch about how much college education stays with you. And one of his lines is economics, I say supply, you say demand. Well, I apply that to this book, and so in light of the 5-minute university, geopolitics, a resource, divide and rule, and add to that indigenous popular movements and religious military pawns with favors, protections, proxies through client states. Basically, this blueprint I've seen over and over and over again. I'm not a, I don't consider myself a historian who knows all about, who knows, you know, tons of history, but just from reading various history over the years and seeing these repeating patterns, there's a resource, in this case the Middle East, obviously the oil, and this policy of divide and rule. And with the basic goal, along with the resource, and is keeping indigenous and or popular movements, peoples in check. So, you know, there's a limit to certain freedoms that are, quote, allowed, and then using of other people in other countries as kind of, you know, pawns to serve the cause. So the back of the book says, in this groundbreaking book, Mark Curtis reveals the covert history of British collusion with radical Islamic and terrorist groups. Secret Affair shows how governments since the 1940s have connived with militant forces to control oil resources and overthrow governments. The story of how Britain has nurtured the rise of global terrorism has never been told. Drawing on declassified government files and new material unearthed during the Arab Spring, Secret Affairs exposes how Britain has supported radical Islamic groups in Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Libya, the Balkans, Syria, Indonesia, and Egypt. Mark Curtis also documents Britain's hidden alliance with two major state sponsors of radical Islam, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and how British policies of divide and rule, rooted in the empire, used Islamic forces to promote imperial interests in India, Palestine, Jordan, and Yemen. Holy shit, that's a mouthful right there. So, I mean, you're naming all those countries, how else can you think of it but as policy, not, whoops, we made a mistake. So, starting off with the introduction, one of the ideas is that both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are partly British creations. The actual forming of the countries, Pakistan with the 1947 partition with India, and that created a major loss of lives and much chaos. Saudi Arabia, that's mentioned somewhere in here, they're propping up there, some guy named Saud, where I think the name comes from. So here we have the, and also some of the secular, has also been as a buffer against, quote, Soviet communism is the other angle, the oils and resources in the Middle East, and then these geopolitical strategizing is a concern over Soviet communism. Secular nationalism and Soviet communism in the cases of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan as conservative muscle within countries to undermine secular nationalists and bolster pro-Western regimes as shock troops to destabilize or overthrow governments, as proxy military forces to fight wars, and as political tools to leverage change from governments. So that's the way they've been used, the radicals get used. And then he highlights energy resources and governments that will promote Western-friendly oil policy, and extending it to the U.S. empire as the time has gone on. Now, here's again at the end of the introduction. My understanding of Islamic radicalism is based on the definition of the widely respected French expert Olivier Roy, in that it involves a return of all Muslims to the true tenets of Islam, usually called Salafism, the path of the ancestors, or fundamentalism, and a political militancy that advocates jihad in the sense of holy war against the enemies of Islam. Islamists see Islam not merely as a religion, but as a political ideology which should be integrated into all aspects of society. So you have this, religiosity, extremist, fundamentalist religiosity mixed in with political
motivation. Here, I guess here's the word, political militancy. So that creates that kind of, craze for the cause. And in chapter one, Imperial Divide and Rule. First step towards British Empire in the Muslim world came in 1765 when the Mughal Emperor in the rich province of Bengal granted the British East India Company the right to raise revenue and administer justice there. And we hear about the caliphate a fair amount in the news nowadays. And again, that sort of plays to this, a sort of second coming type of psychology of a leader uniting all the Muslims. So nothing innately wrong with that. But when it gets put into this geopolitical framework, it becomes an issue. So again, the buffer between Russia and British India. So again, this geopolitical strategizing, about control of areas and peoples and resources. The Hindus and Muslims, I think was the India-Pakistan partition. And as I quoted in my essay, a recent essay writing about the corporation, we have this Secretary of State, blah, 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 these lords and Secretary of States in British rule in India. We have maintained our power in India by playing off one part against the other, and we must continue to do so. Do all you can, therefore, to prevent all having a common feeling. So there it is. I mean, this policy, again, the divide and rule going back to ancient Rome. And this is in sharp contrast with, everything I've learned and look to apply in my life and see how it works with in the world of a holistic view, a holism, looking at the whole picture and the body, mind, spirit, the integration. The way physical substances can help heal, but the attitudes and emotions affect it, and on an even deeper level, the spiritual level is connected with the healing, the overall healing process. So the geopolitics all seems to be disconnected from that, as with mentioned in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous Peoples History of the U.S., where the U.S., the Constitution, one of the key things they left out was the connection with the spirit world and the respect, not just the mystery part, but the respect for the beings, the way natives will ask permission to gather plants and herbs. This is a respect not just for the physical herb, but for the spirit of the plant. So this is my 5-minute Father Guido Sarducci bit. This is, the essence of it. Divide and rule or holistic. And back to the geopolitical stuff. You've got the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which later became BP. So this tying in with what Iran's connection to the current news. And again, the little I know, but I'm learning from this book about the post-Ottoman Empire and the shift from the Ottoman Empire and that whole strategizing, again, in these areas going on in the world today with Turkey, Arabia, etc. And Syria affected too. And also mentioned with Salafism is Wahhabism, which according to this, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, born in 1703, beginning of that stuff. Following the Arabs' revolt and Britain's defeat of the Turkish armies throughout the region, Hussein proclaimed himself king of all the Arab countries, including the Hejaz, but the British government was prepared to recognize only his control of the latter. Confrontation over the future of Arabia ensued between Hussein and another British protege, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, an emir and rising power in Central Asia, whose forces had captured the Najd region with its capital at Riyadh. British officials had been split on who to champion as the leader of the revolt against the Turks. The British government of India had feared British sponsorship of an Arab caliph who would lead the entire Muslim world and the effects this might have on Muslims in India, and had therefore favored Ibn Saud, whose pretensions were limited to Arabia. In contrast to Hussein's orthodox Sunnism, the future founder of Saudi Arabia sat at the head of an ultra-conservative Sunni revivalist movement known as Wahhabism, which professed a strict adherence to the tenets of Islam and which had developed in the 18th century based on the teachings of the theologian Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. The Ibn Saud's military forces were the Ikhwan, or Brotherhood, a militia of Bedouin tribesmen instructed by religious teachers who were committed to the purification of Islam and the advancement of government based on strict Islamic law. So, again, this just astounds me. It's like a wax stew. You're mixing in politics. They're mixing in politics, religion, the trying to control the people, playing off some people off another, using various leaders and to try to get a foot into areas. And it just seems, again, without knowing a lot of history, it just seems like the blueprint for much of the craziness we read about today. Here it is. Ibn Saud established Saudi Arabia in an orgy of murder. That was stuff that was going on in the mid-1920s. In his expose of the corruption of the Saudi ruling family, Saeed Abu-Rish describes Ibn Saud as a lecher and a bloodthirsty autocrat whose savagery wreaked havoc across Arabia, terrorizing and mercilessly slaughtering his enemies. So you're not talking about just the British, that corrupted these people, but there's other angles to it. Then we have 1932, officially proclaimed in 1932, and to a large extent a British creation, Saudi Arabia would go on to act as the world's main propagator of fundamentalist Islam, providing the ideological and financial center of global jihadism. Indeed, Saudi Wahhabism has been described as the founding ideology of modern jihad. Again, it's the extremist stuff here. It's not talking about the religion per se, but these extremist aspects of the religion and how it gets militantly politicized. The new state of Saudi Arabia, its regional authority underpinned by a religious fundamentalism, gave Britain a foothold in the heart of the Islamic world in Mecca and Medina. More broadly, Britain had succeeded in achieving its goal of a divided East and a ring of client states out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. The Gulf states ringing Saudi Arabia in Aden, Bahrain, and Oman were all feudal regimes underpinned by British military protection. So there we get, again, the recipe of put somebody in power, protect them, and have that person in power be a means for controlling the masses. And eventually this gets tied in with the whole Israel-Palestine sort of partition. Here's another little bit. The regimes that Britain had created were puppets, essentially law and order governments allied mainly with the traditional ruling classes of Islam. In turn, these favored sultans, emirs, or monarchs saw British rule as providing protection against the dangers of instability or emancipatory nationalist movements that had begun to stir, notably in Iraq. That reminds of the recent former CIA guy who was interviewed. He's got a new book out, last name Nixon, talking about how Saddam Hussein, although, not so nice a guy, at least he was in touch with his people and there was a control of stuff, and that he had predicted that the ISIS and the chaos that would ensue. But he wasn't listened to. And then there's some interesting stuff about the Nazi and Muslim alliances, people helping, different people helping other people. So the whole geopolitical chaotic world is like people doing favors for people and all that kind of stuff. Second chapter is partition in India and Palestine. By the 1930s, the idea of a separate Pakistan, meaning land of the pure, an acronym of Punjab, Afghan, Kashmir, Sindh, and Baluchistan. Interesting. So these whole ideas that get hatched and some of the later stuff that happens is quite fascinating. He does note that some of the history and the research is not clear. It's like different sides as to how much it was deliberate, how much it was circumstances, how much it was generals in the field compared to the, politics in the office, so to speak. But overall, it's pretty from what I can gather from it overall, it's pretty damning evidence. There's enough evidence to say that, you know, the stuff that unraveled from these various examples certainly has an edge of deliberateness, or at least, you know, to take advantage of, typically with the resource as the big prize. Further on in the chapter, the British have long tried to use the Muslim card to exert leverage over the Hindu nationalists, since they had few other means to maintain British power in the face of a popular movement against it. There were no other major political forces to turn to, and overt military intervention was out of the question. So that's very telling of, you know, today's world, when certain things happen, false flags, this, that, and the other, when the overt military action would actually cause a public uproar. So they find sneaky means to do things sometimes. And again, he highlights what's obvious to anybody looking at the region. The regions might be the battleground not only for the material struggle for oil, but also of the spiritual struggle of at least three great creeds: Christianity, Islam, and communism. Therefore, the Western powers must surely be in the Middle East. Also, Judaic. And here he's highlighting the roots of the extremists. Pakistan will go on to become a balance to neutral, non-aligned India, joining the U.S.-backed Baghdad Pact military alliance in the 1950s and offering the U.S. airbase facilities to spy on the Soviet Union. In the 1980s, it was to act as a forward base for intervention in Afghanistan, precisely its utility as seen by British military chiefs over 30 years earlier. Pakistan also created a state that had little to bind it together other than an adherence to Islam, and which, under military rulers lacking any other domestic legitimacy, would later propagate extremist versions of Islam and nurture jihadist groups. Kashmir's division between India and Pakistan not only became a constant source of conflict between the two states, Pakistan's Islamic cause to liberate Kashmir from part Indian control would help advance the jihadist movement far beyond the subcontinent. And then it gets to the Jewish creation of the State of Israel. In November 1947, the UN passed General Assembly Resolution 181, partitioning Palestine and awarding the Jews a state that comprised over half the country against the will of the indigenous majority population. This was addressed in the Ilan Pappe's book, Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which he quotes here quite extensively in this chapter about the partitions, with Jordan as a kind of British buffer zone. And this proxy through its client state, a strategy typical of post-war British foreign policy, proxy through client state. And that's pretty much it on chapter 2. But again, you know, the whole Soviet communist scare thing, and I see these things as how masses of people with a certain ideology and the powers that be not wanting any mass ideology to control, hence prevent the common feeling. But meanwhile, they want to have their common feeling of a way things should be. But that really, that the common feeling that they seek to create is built on chaotic division. So chapter 3, which about halfway through, shock troops in Iran and Egypt, gets into, again, with Iran and oil, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, AIOC, or would become BP, which was quoted as British control in Iran. It controlled Iran's main source of income, oil, and by 1951 had become, according to one British official, in effect an imperium in imperio, an empire within an empire. And we see that nowadays, where we have certain corporations, that are bigger than, you know, countries. So the Iran, and then that gets into the, I think it was 1953, the overthrow of Mossadegh, and that's when the Shah came in. So again, it was, you know, nationalizing of oil, which is what Chavez helped to do for Venezuela, but that in Iran that led to overthrowing Mossadegh and the use of provocateurs, or what he calls shock troops. He explains that whole game. And then a similar type of thing in Egypt. There's a bunch of mention of the Muslim Brotherhood, which I had first heard about when all the Egyptian, the Arab Spring and things like that were going on there. So more parts to come with this book as it goes on, but just wanted to get some of the gist of it out there. So again, it's looking at all the different factions and things going on with the various forms of Al-Qaeda and Daesh and ISIS and all these Al-Nusra, all these names which it's hard to even keep up with, and all the factions in Syria and the fighting there. I can't say that it's all the same thing, but it certainly, seeing from this book the way the policies have been around for over about 100 years, it seems that basically, again, I say a resource, you say divide and rule, and to help rectify that, I think as is seen throughout the news again, this coming together, whether it's Standing Rock or Black Lives Matter or the quote environmental movement, these are waves of people coming together and working together, and that I see that mentioned a fair amount, not only the individual groups but the cross pollination or cross working together of these groups is important. The way the non-natives and veterans have come in to help protect Standing Rock. So with this long history of divide and rule, there's also a longer history of communality, not communism, but communeness and holism, which, as fascinatingly, like the Lakota have no word for exclusion, only inclusion. So there, it's like there's a indigenous peoples with a holistic view built into their way of life. So I think we need to look to all these possible ways of solutions. I mean, could do whole shows on just the topic of holism itself, but for now, just that premise that there are forces that are looking to divide and rule things, and that they're in a very simplistic but I think essential way, it's the being hip to that and what divides, and not getting caught up in that in a way that could happen with personal relationships and gossip, not getting caught up into that, but rather looking to build connections and bridges with people. And that is part of disempowering the colluding chaos of divide and rule. So blessings, and may you feel well and whole and connect with others of like mind, and even connect with and create something positive with those of with different mind. So thanks for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a few minutes of Sufi music with Rumi poetry.
Ask for what you really want. Don't go. back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. I would love to kiss you. The price of kissing is your life. Now, my loving is running towards my life, shouting.